Jah bless you blistering Christies. Welcome to the Blind Buy Podcast. If you're a brand new listener, maybe consider going back and listening to some earlier podcasts to establish yourself with the lore of this podcast. Plus there's tons of episodes. There's almost 200 episodes on many varied topics. And I try and make each podcast in such a way that it doesn't date. They're not. Some bits are specifically rooted in the time that the podcast is made, but in general I try and make a podcast that can be listened at any point. I often recommend people to go back to the start and listen to the podcast from the start to fully establish yourself. If you're a regular listener, you know the crack. And what's the crack? So the last two podcasts were rather deep dive, hot take, historical podcasts about history and about art. And I had a number of conflicting hot takes for this week's podcast. I had a couple of potential hot takes, but they're not ready yet. They're still boiling away on the pot. And I don't like getting into a hot take until I've got a decent thesis formed. I need to have a story to tell. I need to go into some research and find a story for the hot take. So I don't have that. Don't have that right now. So this week what I'm going to do is I went to Instagram and asked you for some questions. So I'm going to do a question answering podcast, which traditionally, as you know, when I do a question answering fucking podcast, I always end up answering only one question and promising you that I'm going to answer more questions. I'm really going to try this week to answer multiple questions, okay? And I got asked hundreds of questions, absolutely hundreds. So I'm going to try and keep the questions around things to do with interesting facts. That's what I'm going to do this week. I'm going to answer any questions whereby the answer might be an interesting fact. Let's see if we can do that. So Scott asks, can you speak about Glasgow Celtic Football Club, an Irish institution in Scotland that is a reflection of Irish immigration to Scotland? Well, Scott, I know fucking nothing about football or soccer, or whatever you want to call it. I tell you what I do know. I generally call it soccer, because in Ireland we reserve the word football for Gaelic football, so I tend to call it soccer, even though that pisses some people off. But I know nothing about soccer. Now, I'm not saying I wouldn't do a podcast about Glasgow Celtic at some point, because I'm interested in how it's something that was formed by the Irish diaspora in Glasgow. I find that very interesting. And the history of sectarianism around it and stuff like that. So that's something I might look into and do a podcast about in future. But off the top of my head, when I saw that question, can I speak about Glasgow Celtic? Normally I'd kind of look past a question like that because I don't know nothing about sports. But when I saw it, I tell you what came into my head. So I'm going to tell you a story now which has fucking nothing to do with soccer, but it is related to Glasgow Celtic, even though none of this conversation is going to be about sport. A few years ago, I think I'd have been 20, and this would have been when I would have had particularly bad, I would have been in the middle of particularly bad mental health issues. Very, very bad depression, anxiety and agoraphobia, which meant my anxiety had gotten to the point where I couldn't really leave my house. It was incredibly difficult to leave my house and not get a panic attack. And I would have been about 20 and I was going to weekly counselling in college. And through counselling, I was working on my anxiety and my agoraphobia. So I wasn't going to, if I went to a pub or a nightclub, there would have been a serious risk of a panic attack. Okay, so I simply wasn't going to these places. But now, that's a short term reaction to anxiety. But it's certainly not a way to have a happy life. If you're experiencing anxiety and agoraphobia and you find a little comfort zone in your room or whatever, it can work in the short term, but you're effectively living the life of a mentally unhealthy person. So I was living the life of a mentally unhealthy person, but I was in counselling trying to get better, and I was using cognitive behavioural therapy to get better, which meant I was addressing the fact that if I go to a nightclub or a pub or a supermarket and get a panic attack, the panic attack isn't being caused by being in these places, it's simply being triggered by them. So the root cause of the panic attack is something I have to find within myself. It's for me, it was like self-esteem issues, and I was afraid of being an adult. I was 19, 20. I was fucking terrified of being an adult and being responsible. I didn't think I was capable of it. My self-esteem was too low. So when I found myself in a situation like a pub or a nightclub, because I'm 19, 20, I'm only allowed in there like since I was 18, that was very triggering for me, because these are adult spaces and I don't feel like an adult, and it manifested as panic attacks. Same with supermarkets, because supermarkets meant autonomy. What are you doing in a supermarket on your own? You're purchasing food to provide for yourself. This was terrifying to me, so I'd get panic attacks. So I was discovering all this through psychotherapy and counselling. And then, at a certain point in my therapy, my counsellor said to me, now you have to, all this stuff you're learning about yourself and you're learning about your anxiety, you now have to put this into practice. You have to actively change your behaviour. Which meant you have to have a think about going to the nightclub on Friday. If you're avoiding the nightclub because you might get a panic attack, then the only way to truly move on and to overcome anxiety is to gradually expose yourself to the nightclub. So I did this, it was a Friday night, and it would have been the late 2000s, and my buddies were going into the nightclub, and I said, fuck it, I'm going to go in. And it was terrifying. It was fucking terrifying. But I'd gotten to a point in therapy where I'm like, I need to do this tonight. I'm going to go to the fucking nightclub, and if I experience anxiety, so what? I'm going to deal with it there and then. What's the worst that can happen? That's what I used to say to myself over and over again when I was testing my boundaries. If I do go to the nightclub and I do have a panic attack, what's the worst that can happen? And the worst that can happen is that I have a panic attack in the nightclub and then I leave. So that's what I'd say to myself. So I went to the nightclub. Now, back in those days, people went to the nightclub in Limerick at about 7 p.m. Now, I know that sounds mad. This business of pre-drinking, this business of drinking cans in an apartment or someone's house and then going to the nightclub at 11 o'clock, that only started after the recession. That started around 2013. I remember it starting. But before the recession, during the Celtic Tiger, people had money and things were cheaper. So the average student, and also rent was a hell of a lot cheaper. So students could work maybe one night a week and they had enough money to go to the club at 7 o'clock on a fucking Friday or a Saturday. And capitalism was so rampant during the Celtic Tiger. If you went to the nightclub at 7 or 8, chances are you were getting free drinks. Some company was doing a promo and they were handing out free shots of Jägermeister. So why is the timing of this relevant? So I've got crippling anxiety and I decide I'm going to the nightclub. It's early, it's bright. The nightclub was called Trinity Rooms. We had three massive nightclubs in Limerick before the fucking, before the economic crash. We had three absolutely huge. Like, I'm talking on a Saturday night, they might fly in Deadmau5 to do a gig. That's how much money was around Ireland during the Celtic Tiger in the nightclub scene. It was a different world. So I was in the courtyard of this place at 7 p.m. absolutely terrified. I won't say it was enjoyable. It wasn't enjoyable. I was miles outside of my comfort zone. I had agoraphobia. I really didn't want to be in the fucking nightclub. There was people all around me. I was frozen with fear, terrified that I was going to get a panic attack. I couldn't relax. I wasn't talking to anyone. I was just simply being in the nightclub, and that's all I expected of myself. I'm here. It's 7 p.m. I'm in a crowded area. My worst fear of if I get a panic attack, it's going to be really difficult to escape because there's lots of people here. And I was just sitting with it. I wasn't drinking because alcohol doesn't help that situation. I would have been probably drinking free my waddy from the bar because I'd literally no money. I wouldn't have had a support group. I'd have been there with my friends, but I wouldn't have said to them, I get panic attacks when I go to nightclubs, because back then the stigma around mental health was too extreme. If I'd have said to someone, I'm going to a counsellor and I'm getting panic attacks, there was no conversation around mental health. People would have just assumed, oh, this person is mental. You're mentally ill and you need to be in a mental home. You're mental. You need to be in a straitjacket. That was the attitude then. There was no conversation. People were still using terms like mental breakdown or his nerves are at him. So I wasn't saying to my friends, what's the crack, lads? I've got severe anxiety and I can't be in this nightclub. Would you mind me? Not a chance. I had to keep it secret, unfortunately. Back then. Things have changed now, thank fuck. Now, a positive of that was I had ready access to counselling services in college for free, and there was no fucking queues to get to the counsellor's office. They were begging people to come. Nobody was going to the counsellor's office because there was no conversation around mental health. People were suffering in silence. And to go to the counsellor's office, I had to hide, like, I had to pretend I was going somewhere else. The stigma and shame around it would have been too big. You'd have been seen as like I said, mentally ill and to be avoided. Now, because people are a bit more comfortable with going to a counsellor or speaking about mental health issues, now there's huge queues to access counselling in colleges. And I don't think they've increased the services. Back in when I was in college, there was two counsellors, and that was for the Art College and for LIT, which is another huge institution. So that's two counsellors for maybe 8,000 students. And I don't think it's changed much now. I'm not sure, but I don't think it's changed much now. But the demand has gone up. The demand has gone right up. And there's queues. But anyway, I was gradually exposing myself to intense social situations while having extreme anxiety and agoraphobia. And it was not pleasant, but it was something I really, really needed to do. But because it was early on in the night, the music that was being played, it wasn't necessarily dance music, it was laid back hip-hop and rap music, because nobody's drunk, people are talking, so it's like background groovy music. Now, you know me, I fucking adore music. Music is intrinsic to who I am as a human being. So what I was doing, like internally, what my inner voice was saying, I need to leave, this is terrifying, I'm surrounded by people, I need to leave, I'm gonna have a panic attack. That was my internal feeling. But what I was saying to myself was, no, stick with it. Stick with the fear. So what if you have a panic attack? What's the worst that's going to happen? And I wasn't speaking to people, but what I was doing was listening to the music, because the music was kind of keeping me safe. Like, once I listened to the music, it would calm me a little bit and I wouldn't go over the edge into panic attack country. So I'm listening away to the hip-hop. I love rap and hip-hop, so I know the vast majority of the tunes that are being played, and I'm just listening with one ear and managing my anxiety. And then one song comes on, and it's a rap song, but I've never fucking heard it before. And then when I listen to this song, I forget that I have anxiety. I forget that I'm in a nightclub. I'm now just a functional human being in a space with a few hundred people listening to music, and I'm taken out of my body, and all I care about is, what the fuck is that song and how do I find out what that song is? Because I know that I'm like, this is a rap song, but it sounds like it's from the 60s or 70s. This is blowing my fucking mind. I have to find out what it is. I'll play the actual song now. I'll play you a little snippet of the song that the DJ was playing at that moment.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials, because the revolution will not be televised. revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle.
So I'm there in the nightclub like, fuck me, what is this tune? And I've completely forgotten about my anxiety. I'm not feeling any of this. All I'm just transfixed by this music. And now I'm making a beeline for the DJ booth to find out the name of this track. And I remember the only little, I had healthy anxiety. The only little anxiety I had, which was healthy anxiety, was I was worried, fuck it, what if the DJ is one of these DJs who don't tell people what their tunes are because they're so rare, because I'd never heard this track. And I was worried about that, but that's healthy anxiety. That's normal. There's a reason for that. So I went up to the DJ and I'm like, what the fuck is this tune? What is this song? And then luckily, the DJ was also a total music nerd. And he was thrilled that someone had come up and asked him what the song was. Because he was there 7 o'clock doing a hip-hop, a kind of a laid-back hip-hop set that people aren't dancing to, just there in the background. And he himself wanted to insert this tune from the 70s in and see if anyone noticed, because this is from the 70s and he's playing 90s hip-hop. So your man is dead fucking thrilled, and he's like, "That he's called Gil Scott-Heron. He's one of the inventors of rap music. That song is from 1971. He was doing rap music 20 years before rap." And then I'm like, holy fuck, what's the deal with him? What'd you say his name is? Gil Scott-Heron? Now I'm like talking to the fucking DJ. I've just walked through the crowd because of the beautiful healing power of music to make me forget about the mental health issues I was having at the time. And now I'm being a functional fucking human. And all I care about at that point then is the anxiety's gone. And I want to go home now. But I don't want to go home for the wrong reason. I don't want to go home because I'm scared of being in the nightclub. I want to go home and find that song and listen to it as much as I possibly can. Because now the song's over. So I got a pen from the bar. Because there's no fucking smartphones. I would have had a Nokia 3210. But our brains didn't work like that back then. Like, I wouldn't have thought, with a Nokia 32 then, before smartphones, I wouldn't have thought of, like, texting the name of the song to myself or putting it in my phone as a contact. We didn't think like that with technology yet. So I got a pen from the bar and I wrote on my hand, Gil Scott-Heron, "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised." And all I gave a fuck about was not this thing not rubbing off my hand. And I stayed in the pub or the nightclub, and I went home early because I wasn't drinking. I went home at about 10, and I wasn't going to stay out for a night, because this for me was an exercise around exposing myself to a public situation, trying to get over my anxiety. And that song helped me through it, because all I gave a fuck about was, you're going to go home now at 10, you're going to say goodbye to people, and you're going to get onto the computer, you're going to go on to LimeWire, and you're going to find the song "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised" by Gil Scott-Heron, and you're going to try and read about Gil Scott-Heron and find out, why was this fucker making rap music long before rap music was a thing? Who is this fella? So when I do get home, I found the song on LimeWire. I probably had to wait 3 days to download it. And then I went onto Wikipedia and I looked up Gil Scott-Heron, and it's like, yeah, Gil Scott-Heron, an early funk musician who was messing with poetry, who laid the foundations for what rap music would become way before rap music. And it turns out Gil Scott-Heron's father, who was from Jamaica, was the first ever black player to play for Glasgow Celtic in 1951. And I remember just going, wow, fuck me, what a legend. He invented rap before rap, and his dad was the first black player to play for fucking Glasgow Celtic over in Scotland. What the fuck is that about? So it's Scott, to answer your question, can I speak about Glasgow Celtic? That's immediately what came into my head. When you said Glasgow Celtic, I thought about how that Gil Scott-Heron song and the wonderful, beautiful, healing power of music and the importance of that song in helping me get over my anxiety, and that night that I went to the nightclub and heard that song for the first time, and protected my hand so that the biro didn't rub off or that I didn't forget his name. Because there's no Shazam back then. You couldn't go onto Spotify on your fucking phone. If you heard a song once, if you fucking forgot that song, you'll never hear it again for the rest of your life. This was like someone handing me a very precious jewel that I had to mind. You know? It was a different time. The scarcity of culture and music was different. So I had to hold on to this fucking song in my hand. And my only goal for that night was no longer about sitting with my anxiety. It was about, I'm staying here till 10, because I made that promise to myself, and I'm going home and I'm listening to that song. And it felt fucking amazing. And I felt that sense of a sense of achievement. I've done what I thought I couldn't do 2 weeks ago. I went to the nightclub. It was anxiety inducing, but I didn't have a panic attack. And I'll tell you what else it did to me. If I'd have stayed in my room that night, if I'd have given in to the anxiety and the fear and stayed in my fucking room, I wouldn't have gone out and heard a life-changing piece of music. And that for me was, that's a life-changing piece of music. For someone who's in their bedroom listening, learning how to produce hip-hop is what I was doing at the time, listening to rap music, and then the privilege of someone showing you rap music 10 years before rap. That's one of the most important musical discoveries I ever made in my entire life. But like, just to show the importance of therapy and music and how life-changing it was for me. And in even that moment, that incident of going to a nightclub and hearing that song and it helping me to overcome anxiety, I would have been in my bedroom learning how to produce music and making, we'll say, the earliest Rubber Bandits tracks. And there's a song I'd have made not long after I went to that nightclub called The Greyhound Shuffle. You can hear it on Spotify. And The Greyhound Shuffle, Greyhound Shuffle is a rap song I made, but it's about existential anxiety via the metaphor of a greyhound who can dance. But I'm directly taking influence from that Gil Scott Heron song in The Greyhound Shuffle. They sound similar. And then like a year later from that, or maybe 2 years later, when I'd fully overcome my anxiety and become a healthy, mentally healthy person with confidence, that same place, that same venue, Trinity Rooms, where I was so terrified, I was now doing gigs there because I'd been putting tunes online. So now I'm doing gigs there, and instead of being terrified of being in that space, I'm back a year and a half or 2 years later performing The Greyhound Shuffle in that very space where I was, to a full audience full of people with zero anxiety, doing my thing. That mightn't have happened. That wouldn't have happened if I hadn't have gone out that night. If I hadn't have gone out that night, I wouldn't have heard that song. I wouldn't have made a song as a result of it. It was a really transformative moment for me. It was a really transformative moment. That was the one where I tested my anxiety, and then the next time I went to the pub or the nightclub, my anxiety was reduced by 50%. And that song really helped with that. And his dad was the first black player to play for Glasgow Celtic. So that's how it ties in with Glasgow Celtic. And then I obviously become a huge fan of all of the music of Gil Scott Heron. And you should check him out, because he's an incredible fucking musician and a pioneer and way ahead of his time. Gil Scott Heron ended up having a little renaissance in the early 2010s, just before his death. And I got to meet him. I was gigging at Electric Picnic and I was backstage. And I'm like, holy fuck, there's Gil Scott Heron. So I went up and politely said hello, and I stepped in dog shit in front of him. And then he died shortly afterwards. Completely unrelated. His death is obviously not related to me meeting him and stepping in dog shit, but just a nice little circular narrative. And I don't think I'd really thought of all those things until I got asked that question about Glasgow Celtic. I hadn't connected all those things together. But there you go. That's the synchronicity of human existence. Scott Malley asks, what's your favourite cocktail history story? Oh, well, I absolutely love cocktails. I haven't drank a cocktail in quite some time now because, I don't know, look, we're more than a year into quarantine, and I love cocktails, but I want to be in a bar. I want to be in a bar and have someone make and serve a cocktail, and I drink it slowly in a bar. Making cocktails at home is nice, but it's not the same. It's not the same as being in a bar and slowly drinking a cocktail. My favourite origin story for a cocktail, though, would be, there's a cocktail called Nelson's Blood, which I've never drank this cocktail because the origin story just puts me off it every time. But the cocktail itself actually sounds absolutely gorgeous. It's rum, peach puree, cranberry juice, pineapple juice, and Angostura bitters. So that to me sounds like a nice cocktail. But Nelson's Blood, and it's red, it's a deep red cocktail from the cranberry juice. So that's why it's called Nelson's Blood. But the history of how it got the name Nelson's Blood is, so there was a fella called Admiral Horatio Nelson, right? And he was a British naval officer around the 1800s. Nelson's Pillar used to be a monument in Dublin on O'Connell Street. It's where the spire is right now. That used to be Nelson's Pillar, which was a huge column with a statue of Admiral Nelson at the top of it. And in the 1960s, Irish Republicans blew it up as part of the 50th anniversary of the 1916 Rising. They blew it up because they were like, it's the 60s. Why the fuck have we got a statue of this prick Nelson in Dublin? That's unacceptable. Because he wasn't a particularly nice man. What's the famous quote from him? At the Battle of Trafalgar, which was a naval battle between Britain and France, I think, off the coast of Spain, Nelson famously said, England expects every Irishman to do his duty. Referring to all the Irish they brought on board to be soldiers on the ships. But anyway, Admiral Nelson died at the Battle of Trafalgar. Died at sea. And in order to preserve Admiral Nelson's body, so the British Navy used to run on rum, essentially. The British Navy, who were doing a load of trade with the Caribbean via the slave trade, the British Navy used to take a lot of rum back from the Caribbean, and they used to give rum rations to the soldiers or to the sailors on the ships. So when Nelson died on the ship, they put his entire body, they crumpled it up and put it into a barrel of rum so that the alcohol would preserve his body for when it got back to England, so that he didn't decompose on the ship, essentially. But the barrel of rum that his body was in got mixed up with other rum casks. So sailors were fucking drilling holes in the cask that his body was in and drinking the rum out of it. And they didn't know that his dead body was inside this. And they were drinking dead body rum that would have most definitely had his blood in it, because he would have been bleeding. And the sailors drank his blood rum. And that's where the cocktail Nelson's Blood comes from, because Horatio Nelson's actual body was in a barrel full of rum and sailors drank it. So that's why that put me off. I can't drink the cocktail because of that, even though there's no blood in it. It's time now, I think, for an ocarina pause. Let's have the little ocarina pause so that some digitally inserted adverts can occur.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
That was the Ocarina pause. An advert was digitally inserted by ACAST. I don't know what the advert was for. But the Ocarina pause there is to give you a little warning, because sometimes the adverts are louder than the rest of the podcast and it can be a bit of a fright. Support for this podcast comes from you, the listener, via the Patreon page. Patreon.com/theblindbypodcast. If you're enjoying this podcast, if it's bringing you entertainment, if it's helping you in any way, if it's simply giving you a sense of companionship or relieving boredom, please consider paying me for the work that I'm doing and making it. This is a fully independent podcast. I've got full editorial control. I get to decide who advertises on this podcast. No advertiser tells me what to talk about. It's a listener-funded independent podcast, which is something that's under threat at the moment, I suppose, in the wider podcast space. Making this podcast is my full-time job. It's how I earn a living. I love doing it. I adore making this podcast. And I make this podcast every week without fail because it's listener-funded, because I'm able to do that. I have the resources to make this podcast each week. And it's fucking fantastic. I love it. So all I'm looking for is the price of a pint or a cup of coffee. If you met me in real life and you're like, fuck it, I like this cunt's podcast, would you buy me a cup of coffee once a month? And if the answer is yes, you can do it via the Patreon page, patreon.com/theblindbypodcast. If you can't afford that, if you don't have that money at all, that's no problem. You can listen for free. And then the people who can afford it, you're paying for someone who can't afford it to listen for free. Everybody gets a podcast. I earn a living. What more could you ask for? It's a model that's based on soundness and kindness. And it's been life-changing for me. It's been life-changing. I have been working professionally in entertainment for over 10 years. And this podcast is the first time I've had a predictable, regular income. And I'm just very grateful to you for that. Very, very grateful. So, go to the Patreon. Price of a pint, cup of coffee. Pay me for the work I'm doing, if you can do that. No hassle if you can't. Also, catch me on Twitch once a week. I'm making live music to a video game and chatting. twitch.tv/theblindbypodcast. Thursday nights, about 8:30. Like the podcast. Subscribe to the podcast. Post about it on your social media. Suggest it to some friends. That's always a great help. Getting new listeners to the podcast, especially outside of Ireland and the UK, is fucking fantastic. Also, I get a lot of people coming to this podcast because they've read my books, my two books of short stories, The Gospel According to Blind Boy and Boulevard Wren, which is my most recent book that I released last year. And if you enjoyed my books, leave an old review for them as well on Amazon. That also helps if you enjoy the books. So back to the questions. Sarah asks, what was the last thing that kept you awake at night? So often at night time, I love reading before bed. Because what I've tried to do, I really try and stay off my phone before bed. And I've been doing a good job at that, because the phone screen, lads, the phone screen will keep you awake at night. It's not good to be glaring into a phone screen just before sleep. So I'll usually look at my Kindle, which doesn't have a glary screen, and I can access the internet on that. I look at my Kindle or I read books, and sometimes I fall down information holes at night time. I'll decide that I need to look up something ridiculous. And the last thing I can remember reading about that kept me awake, because it was such a mad story. So I was reading about this house in America, right? There's this house in America that was built in 1886 in San Jose, California. And the thing is with the house, it's a giant mansion. Now, I mean fucking huge, but it's the weirdest looking man. It's It looks a bit like the Adams family house. It's this huge old school mansion. And it's got 160 rooms, 40 bedrooms. It's got 10,000 windows, 2 basements, 2,000 doors. But then it has like corridors in there that lead to absolutely nowhere. And there's one corridor that, and underneath it is like an 8-foot drop. And you fall, if you fall down it, you end up in the kitchen. And you're kind of like going, why is there this huge fucking mansion with corridors that lead nowhere and doors that are utterly pointless and 10,000 windows? Like, what is this fucking house? Why? Who would build such a giant mansion that doesn't function as a house? And I went looking into it, and the woman, so it was built by a woman called Sarah Winchester in 1886. And the name Winchester, her husband was the inventor of a very famous rifle called the Winchester rifle. So this was a rifle in the 1800s in America. It would have been the most popular American rifle in the Wild West. So it would have been the AK-47 of its time. Like, the AK-47 is the most ubiquitous gun in the world. Millions of people have died because of AK-47s. Well, in America, in the 1800s, most people were, like, in the West or whatever, the Wild West, were being killed by Winchester rifles. So, Mr. Winchester died, and then Mrs. Winchester, Sarah Winchester, inherited his fortune from the Winchester rifles. And then she started to get mad, paranoid, right? So she started to get incredibly guilty that because her husband had invented this rifle that had killed so many people, she started to believe that she was being haunted by the ghosts of everybody who had been killed by a Winchester rifle. So she got out of Connecticut where she was living to try and escape the ghosts and made her way to California, San Jose, and then started building this mansion. But then she got it into her head that all the ghosts of the people who had been killed by this rifle had followed her to California and were living in her house. And Sarah Winchester became convinced that the only way that she could prevent the torment and haunting by the ghosts of the dead of the Winchester rifle would be if she lived in a house that was never not being built. So if she could live in a house that was in a consistent and continual stage of construction, then she would never be haunted by a ghost that had been killed by her husband's rifle. So that's how this house came about. It's called the Winchester Mansion. And from 1886 up until her death in 1922, there was continually workmen building on the house. And it got to a point where they didn't even know what they were doing. So they just put windows there for the sake of it. Or they'd build a new wing on the house with a corridor leading to nowhere and big 8-foot drops underneath. Because she was just saying, I don't care, just build, build, build to keep the ghosts away. So that story of the Winchester house and its relationship with the Winchester rifle, when I read that, I couldn't sleep. And not, it didn't freak me out, it didn't scare me. I wasn't frightened. It was just such a, beautiful isn't the word, because I imagine life for that woman was a living hell. That's, she's got mental health issues and some pretty severe anxiety and possibly psychosis. So that's a very sad story. But it's also fucking fascinating. What a fascinating story. What a fascinating reason for this weird house to exist. So Roy asks, Blind Boy, today is 420. Can you speak about cannabis and cannabis legalization? I can a little bit, Roy, but in keeping with the theme of this week's podcast, but I'm going to answer questions and also try and find an interesting fact around the question, because I do have an interesting cannabis fact that I learned recently. regarding the, I'm a big advocate for the legalization of cannabis, all right? Here's the deal with cannabis in Ireland. Cannabis is illegal. It shouldn't be illegal. Because cannabis is illegal, it means that there's only one variety of cannabis that you can buy in Ireland, and it's called Do You Want It or Not? And cannabis isn't regulated. So the cannabis that people have to purchase illegally on the black market in Ireland and in the UK as well, and in other countries where it's illegal, often that cannabis has incredibly high levels of THC, very little CBD. This has been shown to can have harmful effects to certain people who are predisposed to psychosis. And most importantly, it's like, think of it this way. If alcohol was illegal, we wouldn't be able to buy wine. We wouldn't be able to buy beer. We would have one type of alcohol that was made in someone's garage, and it wouldn't be safe, and a lot of people would be dying. But because alcohol is legal, we can choose to buy a regulated product and to decide, today I want wine, tomorrow I want beer, maybe I want whiskey. We have all this choice and can make health-based decisions around how we consume and purchase alcohol. That's how things should be with cannabis. We should have a fully legal market like they have in Canada or some states in America, where a person, an adult, can choose to buy cannabis based on specific effects, and also to buy cannabis that is safe. And safe cannabis generally has a balance between THC and a chemical called CBD. Because cannabis is illegal in Ireland, it means it's controlled by the black market. A lot of the gangs that control cannabis are also involved in human trafficking. They have grow houses where people are trafficked from countries like the Philippines or Vietnam. They're trafficked in illegally and have to work off their passage here in cannabis grow houses, essentially working as slaves growing cannabis in Ireland. Then when the guards raid the grow house, it's the poor person who's trafficked here who gets given a massive sentence, because they're seen as a farmer of hundreds of thousands of euros worth of weed. So it doesn't work. Because cannabis is illegal in Ireland, it's now dangerous and unethical. And this is because of the law. And if it was legal, you'd have ethical cannabis that could be taxed, that creates jobs, that's regulated, and that's safe, like they have in Canada. And if you don't want to smoke cannabis, that's fine. I'm not telling adults to smoke it. Same with drink. I wouldn't tell people to drink. It's your business. But here's the thing with cannabis. If you're against cannabis being made legal in Ireland, you're not anti-cannabis. You're anti-safe cannabis. Cannabis isn't going away. So if you're against legalization, you're anti-safe cannabis. We need an approach to substances in this country that isn't based on criminality. It's health-based. Health-based. So legalize it, tax it, use the revenue to fund addiction services and to educate people. And today, as I record this podcast, it's 4:20, which is the American, it's the 20th of April. And 4:20 is the 20th of April in the way that Americans do dates. But 4:20, at the time 4:20, at 20 minutes past 4, on the 20th of April, everyone around the world traditionally sparks up a joint as part of cannabis activism. And this started, it started in 1971 in California. It was a bunch of high school students in California. Someone had given them a treasure map where there was supposed to be a crop of cannabis growing, and the coordinates on the treasure map were 4:20. And as a result of this, these five students decided at 4:20 on the fucking 20th of April they were going to smoke a joint. And somehow this exploded, and now all the world over, at that time, everyone smokes a joint for cannabis legalization in all the countries where it's illegal. So yes, I'm for the legalization of cannabis. We don't even need a referendum for it in Ireland. the government could legalise cannabis tomorrow. It just requires the political will to do it. I do think cannabis is going to become legal in Ireland at some point, maybe in the next 10 years. How do I think that's going to happen? Well, the government certainly aren't going to just legalise it tomorrow, because I know the Irish government and they don't like to do things that show initiative or creativity or courage, and doing something like that would be too in line with those values, which they don't seem to lean towards. It'll probably work like this. So I think there's like 16 states in America have now fully legalized cannabis for recreational use. Canada has fully legalized cannabis for recreational use. Pretty soon, cannabis will become legal in America at the federal level. We're seeing this happening already, where they're trying to push a bill forward that would federally legalize cannabis, right? Once cannabis becomes federally legal in America, then you will start to see the emergence of giant cannabis corporations, kind of like tobacco. There's big cannabis companies in America at the moment, but they're at a state or interstate level. When it gets federally legalized, you'll get your giant cannabis company, the McDonald's of cannabis. That's going to happen. When the McDonald's of cannabis becomes a thing, sometime over the next 5 or 10 years, they will want to not pay any tax, like the tech companies. So McDonald's of cannabis is going to want to come to Ireland so they can launder their money and not pay tax, because that's what American corporations do in Ireland. They come here to avail of our 12% corporation tax, but end up paying less than 1%. That's what Facebook do, that's what Google do, that's what they all do. So some giant McDonald's of cannabis is going to come to the Irish government and say, we want to set up a corporate headquarters in Dublin, and we'll provide a couple of hundred jobs, and we don't want to pay any tax at all. And the Irish government will say, brilliant, we love that, that's our favourite thing to do. But then the cannabis company will say, you're going to have to legalise cannabis though, if we're to have our corporate headquarters in Dublin. And then the Irish government will say, okay. And that's how cannabis is going to get legalised in Ireland. That's my prediction. That's my very cynical prediction of how it's going to happen. So what's my cannabis fact that I'd like to talk about? Well, I will at some point do an entire cannabis podcast. I think I'd like to have an expert on. There's someone I've been speaking to who is an expert on prohibition, because the history of cannabis prohibition is really, really fucking interesting. So I'd like to chat with an expert about it. I'll do that down the line. But right now, I found out something recently that's really, really interesting. So I'm going to start by talking about Henry Ford and Henry Ford's very progressive use of cannabis and hemp in the early 20th century. First of all, Henry Ford was a bollocks. Henry Ford is the inventor of Ford motor cars. He invented the Ford Model T and Ford cars today. It's the Ford company. So Henry Ford was a pioneer of the automobile. The Ford Model T was the first car that was mass produced on a production line, because that was Ford's thing. He was all about getting as many cars out there as possible using these modern techniques of conveyor belt production. But Henry Ford was an incredible racist, like a real fucking racist and a massive anti-Semite. Like, I could even do a podcast that traces the roots of conspiracy theories today, like QAnon, right back to fucking Henry Ford. Like, there was this fake manuscript called The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. It was made in Russia, and it was like a fake pamphlet that was supposed to be, so it was fake news in the late 18th century. It was like a fake news propaganda document that was made in Russia, and it supposedly revealed that the secret plan of the Jewish people, that the Jewish people were this secret, they were plotting this secret plan to enslave all of humanity, and that they're in league with the devil, and that they eat babies and all this horrible shit. And today's conspiracy theories that are very anti-Semitic, like QAnon, they have their roots in this Protocols of the Elders of Zion fake news thing that came from Russia. Henry Ford was the person who really popularized this. He took the protocols of the Elders of Zion, presented it as truth, and like funded it being printed and shit like that. He used to always speak about it. The protocols of the Elders of Zion was also used by Adolf Hitler. Hitler used it as evidence that the Jews needed to be exterminated, because he said, here's the evidence, lads, they want to take over the world, they're the reason for all the bad things in the world, let's exterminate them. Like, Hitler quoted Henry Ford in Mein Kampf, in his book. Hitler really, really admired Henry Ford. He had a giant... This is how much of a prick Henry Ford was. Henry Ford was such a prick that in 1938, Hitler, before World War II, Hitler had a life-size portrait of Henry Ford in his office in Munich that he would keep up there for inspiration. So Hitler actively looked towards Henry Ford as an inspiration of what he should become. Like, the Nazis awarded him the Grand Cross of the German Eagle, which is the highest award that the Nazis could give to a non-German. And even in the Nuremberg trials, after everything came out about the concentration camps, some of the like SS officers, some of the people who were the brains behind the Holocaust, said that a book that Henry Ford wrote, he wrote a book called The International Jew, that's what made them anti-Semitic. So people don't speak enough about that, about Ford. Like, I've done podcasts before on companies that exist today that have their roots in the Nazis, and there's quite a lot. Like Fanta. Like, I did a podcast on Fanta. Fanta was made by Coca-Cola for the Nazis. That's a fact. Hugo Boss made all the Nazis' uniforms. NASA, the American space agency that landed on the moon, NASA was founded because the Americans took like 120 Nazi scientists, gave them new names and put them in America. The Americans got to the moon on Nazi technology. These are all facts. So I had to mention these things about Henry Ford. So Henry Ford was a massive anti-Semite and a racist. But he had an invention in the early 20th century. And had it have gone ahead, we would probably be living in a society whereby the climate isn't collapsing the way it is. And it's kind of depressing. This is a fact I learned that's kind of depressing. So the thing with Henry Ford is that he was obsessed with efficiency. He's the inventor of the production line, about how to efficiently make loads and loads of... The modern production line comes from Henry Ford. Henry Ford's ultimate goal with the automobile, because he was able to see, look, the automobile, the car is going to change the world. What he wanted to do from the start was... He was aware that, okay, these cars that I'm making are made out of steel. And steel is a resource that you get from the ground, and there's only so much of it. There's only so much metal, right? So it might run out, and it's expensive. Same with this petrol shit we're using. It's coming out of the ground, there's only so much. So Henry Ford's ultimate goal was to create a car that could be grown in the ground. A car that's made entirely of something that could be grown out of the ground, a plant. And that plant was cannabis. It was hemp. And it was also, interestingly, this is a contributing factor to why cannabis became illegal in America. It's not the only factor, but it's one of them. So around 1915, Henry Ford became obsessed with replacing petrol. Petrol was a kind of a new thing. He became obsessed with replacing petrol with something you could grow out of the ground. And the obvious choice was hemp seed, the seeds of cannabis, because it's easy to grow, it grows quickly, and there's loads of oil in cannabis seed. So he starts collaborating with a fella called Rudolf Diesel. Rudolf Diesel, of course, invented the diesel motor. They named fucking Diesel after this cunt. So Rudolf Diesel is working with Henry Ford, going, how can we make a type of fuel that comes from hemp seed oil that you grow in the ground? And they successfully did it. Rudolf Diesel designed an engine and a fuel along with Henry Ford, where basically you can run a car off oil that comes from hemp. Now remember, this is like 1915, 1916. The other alternative fuel that's heavily being researched in America at that time too is alcohol. How can we run cars off alcohol? So then coincidentally, right, a nice funny little coincidence, what happens in the 1920s in America? What becomes illegal? Well, first off, they ban alcohol with prohibition, which didn't work. Alcohol prohibition. Alcohol becomes illegal in America, and then cannabis becomes illegal. And the huge pushers for the illegal, making cannabis illegal and making alcohol illegal, was the emerging petrol industry. They were lobbying really hard to push up taxes on alcohol so that petrol would be the cheapest fuel. And they also pushed for, because hemp, like America was, the United States of America was founded upon hemp for fiber, for oil, for all these things. It's a really valuable plant. So the petrol industry pushed for the illegalization of hemp, cannabis, and also alcohol, because these things were direct threats to the petrol engine and petrol as a commodity and fuel. But then skip forward 20 years and Henry Ford is still obsessed with this idea of, I want to build a fucking car that I can grow in the ground, and everything about this car is grown out of the ground. So he returns again to cannabis. So he successfully made in 1941, Henry Ford, the Ford company, made a car made out of hash. They made a hemp car. They developed a type of plastic that was made from hemp fiber, and the engine was running on hemp oil. So Henry Ford actually developed a car that's 100% made out of cannabis that can be grown sustainably in the ground and is also fueled by cannabis. Now, why have you never heard of this? Because the petrol industry really, really lobbied the government really hard for this to not happen. How can you grow a car out of an illegal drug? And prohibition really tied in with this. But imagine how much damage to the earth wouldn't have happened if in 1940 they stopped making cars out of steel and stopped using petrol, and instead our cars were made out of hemp that could be grown on the ground, this plant that grows really quickly. Imagine what the planet would be like today. So there's my little interesting cannabis fact. Henry Ford successfully made and ran a car out of hash. And, you know, it's depressing because you look at, holy fuck, the damage that fossil fuels have done. But there's also a bit of hope there because you go, well, if they did it in the 1940s, why can't you do it now? Like, here's the thing. This illusion that we've been sold that fossil fuels are the only solution. Like, I have a phone now. I could literally fart into my phone and a person in China can hear my fart live. Are you telling me that we can only get energy from oil in the ground? That's the best we can do? No, fuck that. There's loads of different solutions. There's tons of different technologies to provide us with energy that are sustainable, that are organic, that don't exploit the earth. It's just that the companies that exploit the earth and exploit resources were the ones that had the most power, and they shaped narrative and they shaped science, and they did everything in their power to keep back any competing industries regardless of what was going to happen to the planet, because they were pricks. So that's a lot of facts. That's a lot of facts for one episode. We're at the 1 hour point now, so I'll leave you be. I don't know what next week's podcast will be. Maybe a hot take. Maybe I might have someone on to talk. I'm not sure. It's getting close to May. May, lads. I think possibly the most beautiful month of the year. It is. Because it's young summer. And you have the beautiful, I can't wait for the first week of May. First, second week of May. Because of how the air smells. I was looking at a swan last week. There's this little swan down by the river when I go for a run. Which is not little, she's huge. But So this swan is in the river in a marshy bit, and she's after building this giant nest. It's amazing looking. It's just this perfect mound, and it's huge. It's the size of an armchair. And behind it, it's protected by this wall of reeds. So as far as she's concerned, it's protected from the river. She's hidden behind these reeds. But where I run past on the footpath, I have a clear view of her nest that she thinks is private, because she's not trying to protect it from me, because I can't get to it anyway, because I'd have to go through water. She's protecting it from the river. Plus, she doesn't have to. I don't want to go near her nest. What a fucking depressing way to spend an afternoon. Wading through mud to interfere with a swan's nest. No thanks. So I've got this perfect view of this swan with her giant nest. And she's sitting on like 5 or 6 of these huge eggs. And she's just nudging on them and adjusting herself. And I just have this perfect clear view every time I run past. And I'm really looking forward to just checking in on her every second day and looking at her in her nest and waiting for those fucking eggs to hatch and tiny little fluffy cygnets coming out. I can't fucking wait. And then watching them turn into teenage swans over the summer. That's what I'm looking forward to. And of course, the lifting of quarantine restrictions. I'm looking forward to that as well. All right, dog bless. Have an enjoyable week. Glorious cunts.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.